Hello and welcome. The Portavoot Institute for the Study of the Iranian World welcomes you to another episode of our podcast, Legacies of Ancient Persia. Join us as we further explore the many legacies of ancient Persia and its relevance to global patrimony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Legacies of Ancient Persia. This week, our guest is Dr. Julian Dagan, a research fellow and academic teacher at Trier University. In this episode, we discuss assessing Alexander of Macedon as a statesman rather than just as a conqueror, Alexander's treatment of Greek mercenaries fighting for Darius, and the reconstructed Roman merchant boat project at Trier University. We hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give our show a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify.
Awesome. Thanks for joining me, Julian. It is a pleasure to have you join me on the podcast. And I want to start off by asking you how you got into the field.
Hi, Alexi. So thank you very much for inviting me to your podcast. I'm very honored. Well, I got in the field when I was a student of history back in quite long ago in Innsbruck. I think it was 2012. And I got into the field by meeting Robert Rollinger, who later became my PhD supervisor. And he was an absolutely inspiring person, both to talk to in private and during the lectures. And so, yeah, I came into touch with ancient history, and it was an ancient Near Eastern study. So it was love at first sight. So I totally fell for the subject, and I changed my studying program from history to ancient history and ancient Near Eastern studies.
That's awesome. I mean, that must have been influential. I mean, so obviously, Robert has a really long array of topics that he's interested in, and we had him on the podcast a little while ago. And so, you know, out of all the things that he does, what was it about his research that really gripped you, that you were like, oh, I'm really interested in this?
Well, talking to Robert is like reading an encyclopedia. It's like, you know, he knows everything, and you can talk with him about almost all kinds of subjects related to history. But what really caught my interest was, yeah, his work on the Achaemenids, like this imperial perspective on the Achaemenids, and especially how the Greek authors like Herodotus responded to this phenomenon of empire. And it really caught my interest because, you know, it's not just reading sources in one way, it's just reading sources in a different way, like the dialogue with this empire thing. And it gives another dimension to ancient texts. And it's really interesting to me. It's just much more than simply reading them and rationalizing them. It's like a new level of meaning. And that was absolutely inspiring to see that. And it was also inspiring to get an introduction to the ancient Near Eastern texts and all these parallels you can draw between Greek texts and ancient Near Eastern texts. It's like these different cultures in dialogue. That's perhaps that what triggered my interest.
Yeah, well, you know, we talked to Robert a little bit about empire, obviously, since that's what he does. And I'm curious, you know, so I asked him for his definition of what makes an ancient empire, and we got some really good material. And, you know, so I don't want to ask you exactly the same question. So I'm going to ask you the same question in a very roundabout way, you know. So let's go with, when we talk about empire, obviously there are key characteristics that make something an ancient empire. And now studying the same kind of period of history, Achaemenid history, you know, you've got, you know, 5th century Greece right there. And so when the Athenians were kind of in power and the Delian League was at its height, would you consider the Athenians to have had an ancient empire?
Well, there are different definitions of what makes an empire an empire. But of course, I would say that the Delian League, led by Athens, was an empire in some way, but it lacks a specific key feature, at least to me, and that's this multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious characteristical feature that you can, for example, that you have, for example, with the case of the Achaemenid Empire. And that's to me, the most interesting aspect of Achaemenid studies is that you can study this whole empire within different settings, cultural settings, and how these different cultures interact with each other within an imperial framework. And that's the very interesting thing, because during the 18th and 19th century, especially Europeans were just thinking in terms of national states when they wrote history or when they described the world. And you see, we have something in antiquity that appears as rather modern to us, like a big state where all kind of people live together, mostly peacefully, and different religious groups can coexist together, and they share this empire as their common identity. And the empire promotes and fosters identity. That's the very interesting thing to me. So, but I think this is an aspect that we do not, that the Aptian League does not have. So it's perhaps a smaller Greek imperial formation. But we see definitely an empire rising in the Greek world with the Macedonians, at least after Philip II won the Battle of Chaeronea in 338 BC, and when he created a multicultural empire. I think that's perhaps the first empire in the Greek world. And the Delian League is, I would say, an imperial formation, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's kind of a subject of contention because I would tend to say, oh yeah, I mean, I feel like it was an empire, but I do love asking the experts whether they think it was or wasn't. So, yeah, I mean, okay, I'm really happy that you brought it to Alexander because I know you like doing Alexander stuff. And so, do you want to get into Alexander? I mean, so you mentioned just now, right, that you think that was sort of the really the truly the first empire that started. And for listeners who are kind of unfamiliar with this period of history, they know who Alexander is, right? But they don't know much about kind of they kind of know the general idea, you know, Alexander, Macedon, Philip II died, and then he starts conquering everything and then dies, right? That's like what people know. So let's go a bit deeper into Alexander. But also, I do want to hear what is it about Alexander's conquests that really create the first true empire?
Thank you. Well, people may know Alexander now, very recent time, from this famous Netflix series, which is still going on, which splendidly produced. And you have it provides a nice overview on the history of Alexander. But most of the people just see Alexander the Conqueror, you know, this famous general who is able to subdue almost the entire world. So that's, for example, you have there's still books appearing that with a title something like Alexander and the Opening of the World, or a Military Genius on the Throne of Macedon, or something like that. Well, and these books only focus on Alexander the man, and I think that's the big problem. It's a very traditional approach, in the until the 70s and 80s, all these biographies of the big man of history has been published, and it's something like it's pretty much the same approach. So it's focused on Alexander the man. They try to well, all these authors try to act like psychologists, try to understand Alexander, and I think that's perhaps the wrong approach, because our sources do not tell us much about Alexander the man. There are meditations or discourses on kingship, and those discourses are embedded in cultural settings that are alien to the ancient Alexander. So it's pretty hard to know Alexander, who Alexander was and what he has fought, although some authors attempt to say or to state that they knew how Alexander fought and how his decision making was. So we don't know that. But we can reconstruct the political framework of Alexander, and that's definitely the framework of empire. And then you see a lot of dialogues between Alexander and the Near East, and you can go against the paradigm that Alexander was a Western conqueror who brought culture to the East, and Yeah, and if you compare these Western sources, let's say, with the Eastern sources, you see a dialogue between Alexander and ancient Eastern traditions. This has nothing to do with the view entertained by scholars who still think that Alexander was something like a colonial, let's say, conqueror, and compared Alexander to the Spanish, British, French empires. So still, our image of Alexander is mostly the image of those historians who lived in the 18th and 19th century. So Alexander is always used as to say project contemporary times to antiquity and discuss contemporary discourses by using Alexander. And that's a fascinating thing.
You know, it struck me as, you know, you're sort of explaining Alexander and how we sort of perceive him and how maybe that's not totally the way we should. Maybe we should open it up to looking at other ways. And so one thing that struck me, you know, as we're on this conversation of sort of empire and building, but also looking at him not just as this colonizing person just coming in and conquering. There were many different kinds of empires in the ancient world. And one of the things that I guess I've been thinking about is it's one thing to come in and kind of take over and conquer lands and then kind of move on. And there are many examples of ancient empires that don't do a great job of trying to truly assimilate and sort of embrace kind of the territories that you go in and basically conquer. And from his reputation, Alexander did a pretty decent job, a pretty good job. You know, he went in, he kind of embraced these cultures and these places. It's you might have assumed that he would come in and sort of say, okay, well, I really want to make everything just like Macedon, like Greece. But we have the sources and these tales of him sort of embracing, especially the Near East when he went in there. And I'm curious in terms of having a good, cohesive, lasting empire, how big of it is it? Like, is it how important is it to truly try to lean into whatever cultures that you are essentially going into conquering and then trying to assimilate as part of your territory? Because obviously Alexander did it, and from what I remember reading, people appreciated that he didn't just kind of say, "Oh, this is savages and terrible. This everything needs to change," and that he actually liked to take on some of these different traditions. So that part of what made him so successful is that his will, his super willingness to embrace things, because obviously a lot of people didn't.
Yeah, thank you. That's your question aims right at the heart of this scholarly discussion on how to assess Alexander as a statesman. And I would say to build an empire, it's important to gain acceptance of your military hegemony by all the inhabitants of the regions that you conquered. And being accepted as a ruler provided Alexander with the opportunity to build up something like an empire. Actually, it's very hard to term the state of Alexander because it's coming to terms with Alexander's state because, you know, he died rather early, so we do not know what his plans were. But it seems that he created a stable empire and various kinds of people accepted his rule. Like, for example, the Greeks living in Asia Minor, or the Jewish communities living in the Levant, the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians, the Iranians, the Indians, just to name a few. There were a lot more people with a very that shared a very, very diverse and ethnic and cultural backdrop. So what I'm trying to say is that if you want to conquer an empire or create an empire in antiquity, you have to get in dialogue with the people. And scholars mostly compare Alexander with the Roman Empire, you know, in terms of, let's say, stating that the Romans built up a very homogeneous and very, let's say, a current empire. But what is Romanization? I think that's the main question. Romanization is not making everyone a Roman. It's like it was much more that the Roman elites get into dialogue with the subaltern groups of their empire and formed a very diverse political landscape. You know, they always historians of ancient Rome always say that Egypt, Roman Egypt, was something like a special case. I have this wonderful German word for that. It's Sonderfall, So if you don't understand something, it's always a Sonderfall. And because we have so much papyri from Roman Egypt, and there we see that the administration and the political landscape were different to that of Italy. And to be honest, we don't know much about Roman Italy at all. We have a few inscriptions, but local organizations are more almost shrouded in mystery. So what I'm trying to say is, even the Roman Empire, that is believed to be very, say, current and Romanized empire, was in fact a very diverse empire too. So I think this applies to all the empires, especially to that of Alexander.
I mean, I love that this is a big topic of debate, and I love that I didn't realize my question would poke quite so much right at its heart, which is great. So when I think about what happened toward the end, right, of his conflict with Darius, I think there's that account, right, when Darius died, but not by his hand. He had fled up into the mountains, and then they discovered his body, which had been left after a betrayal. I think just based on popular conception of how conquering powers sort of defeat the enemy and what happens afterward, and they sort of bring everything back for a triumphant sort of I win. But we have these accounts of he brought Dryce's body back, and he gave him quite an elaborate royal funeral. And I'm curious, you know, is this type of thing common to have the body of like the deceased king and give him like the full honored burial and not treat him like I think what people assume would be like, yeah, you're dead. I won, so go away.
Well, in this case, I would say it's nothing special to, it's not very special to Alexander, because from the very beginning of his conquest, when he still was trying to set foot on the soil of Asia Minor, when he conquered Sardis, the old Lydian capital, there he found a Persian commander, and this Persian commander surrendered to Alexander, and Alexander allowed him to stay with him at his royal court, and he even bestowed some very important offices to him. So this Persian guy made a career under Alexander in a very early phase of Alexander's reign. So this is something I would call imperial knowledge, so that he really knew how to get into touch with the elites. And he even bestowed the Persian satrap of Babylonia, Marsyas. He bestowed him in office, so he confirmed him in office. And when Alexander conquered or entered Babylon after the Battle of Gaugamela, and yeah, there are many instances of how Alexander, let's say, did not change something in the elitary or social or even administrative landscape of the Achaemenid Empire that he found. So giving Darius an appropriate funeral, I think, is perfectly suited Alexander's plan. And but there are some other instances of Alexander's life that are hard to understand. For example, his sacking of Persepolis and burning of the palace. So it's pretty hard to understand these episodes and to contextualize them within, let's say, a coherent narrative of cultural dialogue and empire building. But I think offering Darius, or burying the body of Darius, was important to him to show that the system, the political system, has not changed, but just the ruler, the name of the ruler, has changed. And the Macedonians were perhaps less than 1% of the inhabitants, the whole empire of Alexander. So if they wanted to get accepted as the new political elites, they had to get dialogue with the subaltern groups. But this also caused ruptures. And I would say sacking Persepolis, for example, was such a rupture. And perhaps it was also needed, although the reasons for Alexander to do so are really hard to understand. So that's a big matter of debate in ancient history. But yeah, when the Romans, for example, conquered the westernmost parts of modern days Germany, they bestowed the same local chiefs in their positions and just created new administrative entities. But yeah, this also was a dialogue with the local Elites. And I think elites, that's the most important thing for empires, definitely. So be it the Athenian or the Achaemenid or Alexander's empire.
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, you got to keep the elites happy because they do kind of keep you in power since there are more of them than there are of, well, the leader. But it's interesting how, okay, like the sacking of Persepolis aside, which, as you've said, is kind of a head-scratching decision and a topic of debate. So putting that aside, though, it's fascinating to hear that, yeah, okay, so he strives to give Darius this grand burial to show, okay, well, he's gone, but I'm just next up in the line of kingship, so nothing changes. So it seems like it's an astonishing level of continuity that he would like to project and acceptance and saying, I do care about you as citizens of the Persian Empire. It's okay, I'm here, I'm just next. But one thing that struck me, and I believe you have an article on it that I feel like I read or have somewhere, was on the fact that there were Greek mercenaries fighting for the Persians. And I'm kind of curious to pick your brain a little bit about that, because it seems that, on the one hand, you have this attitude of like, okay, I want to make them like me. I need to show that I'm respectful and I want them to see me as legitimate. And I remember when hearing how he would treat Greek mercenaries who fought against him, on the one hand, I say, okay, well, that makes sense. You don't like that they are Greek or Macedonian and they're not fighting with you. But this harsh attitude of, I think some of the sources say he killed them or he threatened them or something, which I'm hoping you can speak to. But it's interesting, like, why would he not, I don't know, like offer them clemency and say, like, okay, you'll be punished in a certain way, but it just seems like he wants to make people like him so much. So when you have his own people who you could make an example out of by punishing them, but maybe not killing them, why the difference there?
Well, that's a wonderful question. Thank you. I would say the first problem concerning Alexander and the Greeks is that Alexander was not a Greek. He was Macedonian. So the Macedonians had their own language, their own cultural background, and the Greeks, it's fair to say that the Greeks did not like the Macedonians very much because they sided with the Persians during the Persian Wars. And they had some issues on their northern frontiers with the Macedonians. So it's better not to have the Macedonians as your neighbors in antiquity. Those are complicated people. No, and when Philip II conquered Greece and created the Corinthian League, this was not something, a political building or system that was built to invade Persia. It was an instrument of political control for Philip. And they created this treaty. We have this treaty, parts of this treaty. It came to us in the form of an inscription in Athens. And it says that Greeks are not allowed to serve in the army of the great king, the Achaemenid great king. And the problem was that the Greek cities had very serious social and economic problems. So there were too many inhabitants of a polis. The people, its inhabitants had to go away. They had to go abroad. For example, finding a new place to live, to found a new colony, Oikia, or for example, go to the Achaemenid great king and join his forces because the great king was known to pay his soldiers, his mercenaries, pretty well. And we still have in mind when Alexander, or for example, or better, the better example is the Persian army, the Achaemenid army during the Persian Wars. We have in mind Iranians fighting against Greeks. But in this case, we face an imperial army. And this army was built of, consisted of many different people from many different cultures. So it's like Herodotus said, the whole world tried to conquered Greece. So we face this idea of an imperial army. In reality, I think it was rather different. We have these arrows from the battlefield of Marathon. It's like the birthplace of modern Europe, where the West defended itself against the imperialism of the East. That's the main narrative in at least European or even say Western history. But here we say we have good evidence for Greeks fighting against Greeks. At least large part of the Persian army or the Empire's army consisted of Greeks when they invaded Greece in the early 5th century. So same we face the same problem with the time of Alexander. A lot of I would say a large number of the imperial army consisted of Greeks, and the Macedonians had to deal with this problem. So when they killed the Greek mercenaries and displayed their shields at the Acropolis of Athens, everyone knew that you should not fight against Alexander. And Alexander had big issues during his reign. When he was in the east, trying to pursue Darius, the Spartan king Agis III tried to, he re actually rebelled against Macedonian hegemony. So the Greeks were not very satisfied with Alexander, at least some of them were not. And he tried hard to maintain his empire over the Greeks. But the Romans, for example, had the same problems with the Greeks. And those were also the people who produced our sources. So we mostly have the Greek view on things. And when they say it was a very harsh act to kill Greeks, Alexander, for them it was, but not for Alexander. It was just like, killing Persians or someone else who fought against him. But I think that's also a problem of empires, you know, this, or a characteristic feature of empire, these multicultural armies.
Yeah, was it just the Greek mercenaries in particular? Because I'm trying to think, like, I mean, obviously, as he conquers more and goes and he, assume just sort of the territories get larger, he's adding many more people to his sphere of influence. So was there this kind of treatment for other mercenaries too, non-Greeks? So basically, was it anyone who would turn against and fight him, or was it in particular the Greeks?
Well, the sources state that it were particularly the Greeks, but something I would say that's something, but it's an aspect that's emphasized by Greek authors, obviously. A good example that how, say, entangled the ancient world was, and that definitely not only the Greeks were mercenaries in an imperial army, is the battlefield in Sicily of Himeia. There we have the human remainings of the soldiers who fought at this battle. And those bones have been analyzed, and it's shown that they derived from everywhere in the world, so all over the ancient world. So we face a very entangled and international, I would say, even say a globalized world. So, and the Greeks were just one part of that. And we also have people from the Near East living in ancient Greece. So it's not like the world's divided by nationalities. Because nationalities, this concept is absolutely foreign to the ancient world. It's a very mixed up and a highly entangled world. And we think the problem is, to understand Alexander and classical Greece, is that the sources say that the world was somehow uncharted, or a large part of the world remained uncharted until Alexander penetrated towards the east. So they give us this notion or this idea of the Greek world, of a Greek geographical horizon that was limited by the Mediterranean, and perhaps you can add Mesopotamia and Egypt to it. So it's like a very small-scaled world, but in fact it was a very large world. And archaeological findings confirm that. So this is a matter of Greek worldview. And getting rid of this Greek worldview and contextualize it in a broader ancient Near Eastern framework, you can understand how entangled this world was. And Alexander did not force his soldiers to march into lands that were unknown to his contemporaries. These lands were known, and he exactly knew where he had to go. And there are political reasons why Alexander stopped in the East. And there are also political reasons why Alexander interacted with the Greeks in this way and with others. So, just let's say rationalizing sources is perhaps the wrong approach. or the wrong term, but you have to contextualize the sources. And then you, I think you get a rather nice idea of Alexander and his political decision making.
Yeah, he's kind of like a larger than life figure who did us the great disservice, right, of dying so young. So we didn't get decades to see him truly as a statesman and maybe get an idea of, how did he treat people once he had his empire and was ruling it properly. So yeah, he did us all the disservice of dying and then leaving us with speculation about the man, which kind of makes him kind of a, cool historical mystery of, well, what would he have done? And we only get to see him as he's really in his warrior phase and conquering. And so that definitely is a different dimension. There's so much more I could say on it, but I want to make sure you have time to mention your really cool boat experiment project. So please explain to our audience, like, what is this project and anything about how did it come about or like, it's so cool. So please tell us more about your experiment.
Well, the boat. Yeah, here at Trier University, Professor Christoph Schaefer, he reconstructed a Roman merchant vessel. It's like its original size. And they found in the 80s a Roman shipwreck somewhere at the Côte d'Azur. And the shipwreck was quite unique because mostly when archaeologists discover shipwrecks, they discover the cargo and not, there are no more remainings of the ship itself, so the hull of the ship is almost gone. But in this case, so the half of the ship was still preserved by forgeable conditions in the sand of the sea ground. So it was University of Trier, together in cooperation with the University of Applied Science in Trier, they were able to reconstruct the ship, so to produce a plan of the ship. And then the ship was reconstructed, it was built in Trier with the help of students. So we have an original Roman merchant vessel here in Trier, and we can sail it on the River Mosel. And yeah, but sailing on a river is quite boring. So we just decided to get the ship to southern France this summer, last summer, and to sail it under the Mediterranean Sea. And we got there different instruments on this boat, like to assess the wind speed, the wave height, the speed of the ship, and various things, and all this GIS data related to it. So we have this data collected, and then we created something that's called a Bollard diagram. So this is used by shipbuilders to show how good a sailing ship can sail in specific wind conditions. And we use this data to and weather data gathered by the European Union and various American departments, which are do research about the weather and astronomical phenomena. And then we created simulation software to simulate Roman sea routes to get an idea of ancient connectivity. And it's very important to gain insights on Roman economy and the setup of the Roman social hierarchy of the empire. So sea trade was very important because it was rather expensive to transport your cargo across the land, and it was pretty cheap to transport your cargo over the sea. So the ships were like the backbone of the Roman economy, and understanding how seaborne trade has functioned in Roman times is very important to understand the Roman Empire. So that's what we do. So we sailing ships and simulating sea routes. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds really fun. So if I'm a member of the general public and I say, that's so cool, you're recreating it. But also, if I'm a member of the general public and I don't know exactly what these vessels look like or are made out of, when you think of ancient ships, if you're not a specialist in any ancient field, you would maybe bring to mind an image like of a trireme, let's say, right? So tell our audience, like, what does this look like? And is it made out of the same materials? And so, what differentiates your boat from like a trireme?
Well, the trireme is, they have reconstructed one in Athens, the Olympia. Well, that's a much concerning this boat is speculation because we have no reliable sources. to tell us how Tarim actually looked like. What we did is we decided to reconstruct a small Roman merchant ship. And with small, I mean its length is around 60 meters and its width is about 4.5 meters. So that's a rather small merchant vessel compared to those who sailed across the Mediterranean Sea on the high seas. We just, for example, one shipwreck known from southern France, the La Matraque de Chien. It's perhaps the biggest Roman merchant ship known to us, and its length was about 43 meters, and its cargo was about 600 tons. So with our Bisola, that's the name of the ship, it's 16 meters and we can load about 30 tons. That's a rather small ship. But it's still, the question was what it's doable. And to create a small ship, you can sail it with you need 5 or 6 sailors. So it's doable. But it will also be tempting to reconstruct, a large, such one of these large freighters over 43 meters. But we did that, but in a scale from 1 to 3. So it means it's now our 14 meters ship model. But it's not fit for sailing. We used this for different experiments to know how it behaved in the water. So we're working in close collaboration with nautical institutes from the German administration, the government, and they have testing channels and something like that, that we can gain some data and also do simulations with these kinds of boats. But our Bisola is rather small, made out of wood, and you need, let's say, 5 or 6 people to sail it. So it's pretty fun. And it sails very well. We had a nice time in Cannes last summer. We tested the ship for about 5 weeks on the high sea. And we didn't get wet. So it worked well. So the Roman ships were nice vessels, yeah.
Well, that sounds really exciting, and I totally would want to do that if I could, although I unfortunately get quite seasick. So I don't know if I would have survived pretty well in the ancient world if I had to. I don't think I would be a very good merchant, basically. So if I was able to time travel back, I think I'd say, please don't make me a merchant who needs to be a seafarer, because I really would have a hard time. So, I mean, out of my own curiosity, is it pretty easy to actually sail once you're on board? Is it kind of hard? Like, I don't know. I don't even know what I'm envisioning, just because we've had, ancient representations of like ships in films and stuff, but I don't know if that's at all accurate. So, like, is it easy? Is it hard? Like, can you tell just from operating it yourself? Like, would it have been kind of a stressful, really hard lifestyle if you had to like go on a boat and travel for living?
Well, it's definitely not a modern luxurious cruise ship. Well, the sailing is pretty easy. It works just like a normal square-rigged boat. So technology has not changed much over centuries. So it's not like a secret. You don't need secret knowledge to sail the ship. But it gives you sailing the ship at least for 2 or 3 hours gives you an idea how hard these people had to work. So it was no easy life, and they had no cabins to sleep, so they had to sleep on the amphoras or on board. And even in the Mediterranean, it can get pretty cold during summer when you have to sail a boat and you get wet and there's a lot of wind and there are high waves, and we even sailed it in storms. So it was rather spectacular to sail the ship, and it was an adventure. And if I could choose, let's say a job in antiquity, I would not choose being a merchant on a ship, because that's perhaps one of the hardest jobs you can get in antiquity, definitely. And those were no slaves. That's important to emphasize. Those were specialists, the people that were well paid. And there were merchants on board, who, as you know, were the the captain and the seaman, and there was the merchant. And the merchant, he hired the captains and the seamen to get his cargo from one point to another. And finding the right captain was, I think, that was a difficult choice because you have to know much about, you have to get a good knowledge about the regions which you want to sail. So those were specialists and highly valued specialists, but definitely not an easy job. So I cannot recommend it if you want to do a time travel.
Yeah, well, and I'm thinking about you have the benefit, right, of living in the modern era where you have compasses and other things. So the ancient merchants, when you say they're specialists because they have to be, was that basically also you have to learn how to navigate by the stars because you didn't have like astrolabes yet or anything? I mean, what you know, I'm just not familiar with this, with one seafaring technology, but two with that period. So I'm kind of like, I don't know. Yeah, what would they use to sort of help keep direction? Other was it just the stars, or I know that there's like the you put the thing in the water and then it like points north, but I don't know if that had been invented yet.
Well, that's a wonderful question because navigating in antiquity, that's a very interesting topic to talk about. Because if you want to determine your position, your relative position towards the stars during night, you have to know exactly where you are, and then you need something like a clock because you have to know where you get to. So for us today, for us contemporaries, it's pretty hard to understand because you turn on the navigation, your navigation app or Google Maps or something like that, and it guides you wherever you want to. In antiquity, that people had no chance to navigate on the high sea by determining their position towards the stars. So what they did was sharing their experience. Like, there's point A, and when the wind is blowing in a particular direction, you can go to point B, and it takes you 2 or 3 days. And when I was reading Strabo's Geography, that's the most, say, it's the richest geographical account that survived of antiquity that survived until our days. When Strabo describes the Mediterranean, he gives a lot of numbers. From A to B. Overseas, you have to travel 500 states or 800 states or even 5,000 states, something like that. And the first time when I read Strabo, I thought, oh, that's the most boring thing I ever read because they're just numbers of states. And yeah, I'm not interested in something like distances between two points. But then we found out that this is actually the geographical knowledge of the sailors. Because when he says, for example, the harbor A is, you have to go by a specific wind from harbor A to harbor B, and its distance is 1,000 states, it means it takes you one whole day and one whole night to get there. And so we can, so it's a very, Strabo, for example, is a, in his description of the Mediterranean basin or the Mediterranean Sea, is an extraordinary source for maritime knowledge. And our simulations are mostly based on this data, so based on this data. And actually that's the knowledge, or that's the way how the ancients conceptualized space. And until the 18th century, scholars were not able to determine the longitude. So even when there were mathematical so-called mathematical geographers like Claudius Ptolemy, in the 2nd century AD, one of these famous Alexandrian scholars. And he tried to draw a map of the world by using mathematical calculations. This was just an educated guess. He still had to use nautical knowledge of the sailors to determine the positions of places that were far beyond the horizon, let's say. So that was very important, even to very educated and trained scholars like this Ptolemy guy. So this practical experience, that's what people shared in antiquity, and that's what navigation was about. So you have to gain this practical knowledge. You need access to this practical knowledge to successfully get from A to B in antiquity, at least as a sailor.
I would assume, I mean, modern navigating without fancy technology, I'm sure, is still very difficult. Yeah, I mean, and it's such a big, broad topic that I'm sure is super interesting, and I wish I had more scholarly time to devote to learning about ancient navigation because I am so interested. It's just there's, not enough time in life to get into every topic. So, because I think, well, we had lighthouses, I'm thinking eventually, right? The lighthouse, the Pharos in Alexandria, I'm sure helped guide ancient seafarers. I think what was it? It was so tall that you could see it from like 50 miles away or something like that. It was like impressive, but certainly not at this time. They did not have that yet. So, man, I want to ask so many more questions, but we would never ever be done talking. So I shall restrain myself and not do that. But I want to make sure here that I have time to ask you kind of where people can find you. But before that, I sort of end the podcast with two final questions that I like to ask every guest.
Interested in learning more about the wonders of ancient Persia? Visit the UCLA Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran. The Gazetteer digitally preserves famous locations, world heritage sites, and lesser-known areas from all time periods of ancient Iranian history. You can explore using the interactive map or visit the encyclopedic catalog for updates to the ever-growing list of archaeological sites. Visit www.irangazetteer.ucla.edu and learn more about what the Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran has to offer.
The first of these questions is, what do you think is the greatest legacy left to us from ancient Persia?
Well, I would say it's the knowledge how to rule the greatest, the largest empire of its days in history, or at least in ancient Near Eastern history, with diverse inhabitants. With diverse, I mean in diversity in all kind of things like culture or religions, and to make sure that they can peacefully coexist within this large state. And I think that that's this ability is very important to our days when you just think about what is going on in Eastern Europe in these days. And yeah, I think that's something that the Persians perfectly showed us, and we can only learn from coexistence and cultural dialogues, religious dialogues from the Iranian great kings, could be great teachers.
Yeah, definitely. History often has the best. And the second question I have for you is, what do you think would be the best legacy that we can leave for future students of Iranian studies?
Well, I would say keep the publications going on, and there's so many things that still deserve scholarly attention concerning the fields of Achaemenid studies or Iranian studies in general. So there's much more to do, and I think the next generation has definitely will leave let's say much things to do to the next generation. So I think Iranian studies or Achaemenid studies in particular will still going strong within the next decades, hopefully.
Yeah, I agree. Publications are important, and there's always so much new scholarship that was being worked on and that I think will be of great public interest. And so the last question really I have is, where can people find you or find your work or your publications if they wish to learn more? Especially since you do work with Alexander, and that's a topic I know a lot of people, I'm sure, are hungry to learn more about, and especially after things like this new Netflix series that have come out. I'm sure people will be turning to that to see if they can learn something. So, yeah, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on my university homepage of the Trier University. Just Google for Julian Dagen Trier. So it's Trier. By the way, the oldest city in Germany. And yeah, there, or you can find me on all kinds of social media. So, and if you're interested in Alexander, the Achaemenids, or Roman seagoing vessels, just leave me a message. I will be happy to answer your questions.
Great. Well, I will make sure to link all of that in the show notes. So if they would like to contact you and read your stuff, they can. And I just want to thank you one more time for joining me on the podcast. It's been super fun to get to chat and learn more, and I hope you'll come back.
Yeah, I have to thank you, Lexi, for this wonderful opportunity to speak about my research activities with you. And I hope to see you again this June when we will have this conference at UCI about the Red Sea trade in Persian times. So this will be on Achaemenids and maritime studies. So for everyone who's interested, I think it's the Malamu Symposium this year. So you'll find it on the Malamu homepage or at UCI's Jordan Center for Persian Studies homepage. So please join us.
Sounds good.
Legacies of Ancient Persia is a Portavood podcast production hosted and edited by Lexi Henning, with select episodes co-hosted by Marissa Stevens. Cover art provided by Hadley Leesman and original music by Brent Arhart. Established in 2017 as the premier research center for the study of ancient Iran, the mission of the Portavood Institute for the Study of the Iranian World is to engage in transformative research on all aspects of Iranian antiquity, including its reception in the medieval and modern periods, by expanding on the traditional domains of old Iranian studies and promoting cross-cultural and interdisciplinary scholarship. Thanks for listening to our show. It's available to stream on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Portavood Institute and at Portavood UCLA, or visit our website, portavood.ucla.edu. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review us. For podcast inquiries or questions about the Portavood Institute, please email us at portavoodpodcastproduction@gmail.com. We'll see you next time as we continue our deep dive into the legacies of ancient Persia.